From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point this week. Clinton and Benghazi hearings. Biden won't run. Paul Ryan will stand for Speaker. Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, kept her cool in hours of testimony yesterday, cool and sad over the death of four Americans in Benghazi.
I've lost more sleep than all of you put together.
After months of speculation, it's a no from Joe Biden on a presidential run.
Unfortunately, I believe we're out of time, the time necessary to mount a winning campaign for the nomination.
And Paul Ryan turns to say yes to being Speaker of the House.
I came to the conclusion that this is a very dire moment, not just for Congress, not just for the Republican Party, but for our country.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Lisa Desjardins of the PBS NewsHour, Hayes Brown of BuzzFeed News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How did Hillary do? How did the committee do? Can Paul Ryan pull together the GOP as Speaker of the House? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from New York, Hayes Brown, world news editor and reporter for BuzzFeed News. Maybe nude, I don't know, Hayes. Hayes Brown, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you for being here. From Washington, Lisa Desjardins joins us, political editor for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Lisa, and Hayes.
All right. Here we have all these hours and hours and hours of testimony yesterday, the previous hearings on this, and there have been many, not enough, said the Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy, who was heading it all up, chair of the House Select Committee on Benghazi. Here he was, defending the need for his committee to get in here again after all the earlier work.
If those previous investigations were serious and thorough, how did they miss Secretary Clinton's emails? If those congressional investigations really were serious and thorough, why did they fail to interview dozens of key State Department witnesses, including agents on the ground who experienced the attacks firsthand?
Trey Gowdy there. And here's Hillary Clinton saying, well, it's unfortunate that politics are getting in here.
It is deeply unfortunate that something as serious as what happened in Benghazi could ever be used for partisan political purposes. And I'm hoping that we can move forward together.
Lisa Desjardins, there seems a time not so long ago when there was some speculation, and maybe Joe Biden's potential candidacy was riding on this, that she might come out of yesterday's hearings in tatters. How do you see what emerged from these many hours of hearings, Lisa?
I think after 11 hours of watching those hearings yesterday, to me, the final conclusion may not be that interesting. I don't think anyone gained much from yesterday's hearing. I do think Hillary Clinton didn't lose anything, and that could be seen as a win for her supporters, no question. Republicans, no question, were hoping to get more out of her. They obviously are very suspicious of her role in Benghazi. But I think when you take the broad view of this, Tom, what this is about is Republicans question Hillary Clinton's integrity, but Democrats were able to somewhat turn the tables during that committee hearing and question the Republican committee's integrity, how they've handled this hearing. But I think in the final analysis, Tom, the issue for both of them is that voters question nearly every politician's integrity, and I don't think yesterday helped with that.
Hayes Brown, did we learn something, anything new yesterday?
No, and if we did, Trey Gowdy also missed it. After the hearings, he was asked, what did we learn from today? And he couldn't come up with an answer. So it's really kind of astounding that after as much testimony as we had yesterday, that we got absolutely nothing.
There was a lot of talk about Sidney Blumenthal, and here was, Congressman Michael Pompeo from Kansas, going after the access he had to Hillary Clinton versus the access that Ambassador Stevens, who died in Benghazi, had.
Ambassador Stevens did not have your personal email address. We've established that.
Yes, that's right.
Did he have your cell phone number?
No, but he had the 24-hour number of the state operations the State Department that can reach me 24-7.
Did he have your fax number?
He had the fax number of the State Department.
Did he have your home address?
No, I don't think any ambassador has ever asked me for that.
Did he ever stop by your house?
No, he did not, Congressman.
Mr. Blumenthal had each of those and did each of those things.
Lisa Desjardins, what was this all about? Ambassador have what Sid Blumenthal had? Please introduce us to Sidney Blumenthal and why he got so much attention yesterday.
Absolutely. Sidney Blumenthal is a longtime friend of the Clintons. He's worked for the Clinton Association. He's been, or Clinton Foundation, rather. He's been associated with them for a long time. He also had some clients with interests in and presence in Libya during this time. He was emailing Hillary Clinton what he says were advice, information that he was getting on the ground. She says that was no different than any other of her friends, many high-powered friends, giving her a heads up about something that she should know in the world. Republicans see it differently. They think that Sidney Blumenthal and perhaps even Secretary Clinton could have been profiting off of this relationship. And they think that was inappropriate for someone not employed by government to have such influence, as they see it, with the Secretary of State.
Profiting now, in what way, Lisa? Profiting.
Sidney Blumenthal personally profiting off
how,
of
so,
his,
how,
work
how?
As, I mean, work, his work as a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that he perhaps could tell his clients, look, I'm helping you because I have this relationship with the Secretary of State. You could benefit directly from this. Now, that's the theory. The truth is that we haven't seen, honestly, not even a lot of smoke there, but there are a lot of questions hovering over that relationship. That's what they were trying to get at. But that's when the Democrats did turn the table here and they said, you should release the full transcript of your private conversation, your private hearing with Sidney Blumenthal. That's something Republicans said they wouldn't do. They say they're not releasing any transcripts. But Democrats say there's information in that private session with Sidney Blumenthal and the committee that they say refutes the secretary, that helps her case, and that they say is that the Republicans are hiding. It, you know, this kind of gets into the political chess game here. But Sidney Blumenthal is a character of great intrigue.
Here's Hillary Clinton pushing back when the chairman, committee chair Trey Gowdy, pushed on the Blumenthal line.
I don't know what this line of questioning does to help us get to the bottom of the deaths of four Americans.
I'll be happy
help
to tell.
Us
I'll
to
be happy
better.
To help you understand but, that, Madam Secretary. But,
and Congressman Elijah Cummings was happy to jump in, ranking Democrat on the Select Committee, to say, what is this all about? What's going on here?
What is impossible is for any reasonable person to continue denying that Republicans are squandering millions of taxpayer dollars on this abusive effort to derail Secretary Clinton's presidential campaign.
Jack Beatty, what did you learn in all those hours of testimony, sir?
I learned very little, Tom. What I heard, of course, I might have been distracted by breakfast, lunch, tea, or dinner, so long was the session. But all I heard was what Dr. Johnson called the petty cavils of petty minds. You've given an example of that, you know, the long from Representative Pompeo, what street did Ambassador Stevens ever drop by your house, and so on. There was another line of questioning. Were you alone the night of the attacks, the whole night? Let's see. Why did you say your house where you kept your server was guarded by the Secret Service? Was Bill Burns at the State Department when you went home? Was Victoria Nuland? Oh, there were quibbles about some advisor and unsolicited. Throughout, I thought Secretary Clinton displayed a Franciscan patience and a mastery, really, of the relevant information. She was moved when she recalled the dedication of a wounded State Department guard and moving, describing the last moments of Stevens and Sean Smith. I thought, she called for statesmanship, and she's displayed it.
Let's look to our listeners here. Let's see what they heard and saw. John in Boston. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, when I look at what happened there, I think she made a mistake, and she doesn't want to face up to that, but she made probably an honest mistake with that. But she did some things, like they came up and said that there was a video made, and turns out the video had nothing to do with the riot, so they were like hiding stuff. And then when I view Hillary, I don't just view her in light of this. I view her with the email scandals and all the other things going on, and I just don't think she's trustworthy. And that's aside from this, that's when I look at her as a whole.
It goes to trust for you, John, and you're not feeling it. Hayes, what about how she comes off? I mean, perhaps it's very partisan the way people look at this. Perhaps it's not. How do you think she came out of these hearings?
I think she came out mostly unscathed. To his point about the video being made and then not having anything to do with it, What people need to understand is how difficult intelligence collection is in the heat of the moment of things like attacks, like it happened in Benghazi. There was actually a protest beforehand. The New York Times reported that people at the scene did cite this anti-Islamic video as part of the reason for the protest, and later reporting showed that the people who did carry out the attack took advantage of these protests to move in. So what happens when the fog of war gets mixed with politics is that it's very difficult to discern what actually was true when, and that leads to distrust among people who can't or don't follow the issue extremely closely.
Lisa, is there an outstanding red-hot question that, if answered, would either resolve all this, or series of questions even, that would resolve this or would sink Hillary Clinton's ship? Or is it just now we're into endless, you know, back and forth and muddy?
I think I can hear some of your listeners who've been following this probably screaming questions at the radio right now. A lot of people think there are some unanswered questions, but I have to say I'm not sure there's any one that would completely change the narrative. Of course, Republicans think that they need to keep asking the questions, that they just haven't found the right one. I know just on my way here, my mother and I were talking about this, and she said, you know, I'm still not sure what Chris Stevens was doing there in Benghazi. I'd like more on that. So I think there are a lot of those kind of detailed big picture questions that people would like asked. But it's hard to, after now there are four public hearings for this committee, only four, I want to add, for this investigation. But five other congressional committees have had a total of some 17 hearings. So there have been a tremendous amount of questions asked. There have been three reports so far. There'll be a fourth. Honestly, I don't know what the next golden question is.
If they had a bombshell, would they have dropped it yesterday or would they wait?
I think they would have dropped it yesterday.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, Hillary Clinton and the Benghazi hearing. Joe Biden won't run. Paul Ryan is for Speaker. Syria's Assad goes to Moscow. Massive hurricane bearing down on Mexico. Lisa Desjardins with the PBS NewsHour joins us. Hayes Brown with BuzzFeed, world news editor there. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. What did you think of Hillary yesterday? What are your last thoughts on Joe Biden's near run for the presidency? Your thoughts as he says no. And is Paul Ryan right to take up the speaker role or go for it? Can he mend the GOP's wounds, get the party to pull together and govern? A lot of talk about security or lack thereof, sufficient security, even whether the Benghazi station should have stayed open. Here was Congressman Peter Roskam, Republican, Illinois, on the attack yesterday.
No one recommended closing, but you had two ambassadors that made several requests. And here's basically what happened to their requests. They were torn up.
Well,
they
that's just not true, Congressman.
Oh,
I know
Secretary.
Let's go to Matt in Atlanta, if we may. Matt, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just a couple of things that Hillary did not address yesterday. She would not address the reason why she told her family and some close confidants that the reason was not, in fact, the video that spawned this attack in Benghazi. They wanted to play up a story about how it was the YouTube video instead, when, in fact, we know that's not the case. And she never would come out and address that. To me, that paints a picture of dishonesty with the Clintons. And also, you know, she may have made an honest mistake as far as not getting security in time to the embassy. But if she would just apologize instead of trying to talk her way out of it like the Clintons so often do, I think she would gain more respect from the American people. This is nothing new for the Clintons. If you look at all the scandal that has surrounded them for so many years, Whitewatergate, Travelgate, Filegate, Fostergate, I think people are beginning to open their eyes and see, wait a minute, we got a problem.
Matt, we've got it. And of course, there are trust issues that show up in the poll, definitely for Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, you know, she talks about the vast right-wing conspiracy to paint a lot of these. Hayes Brown, if it were possible, and of course it's not, in this arena anyway, to drain all the politics out of this, are there outstanding questions that are burning to you?
Not particularly, which is surprising. I mean, the thing is that people keep talking about this video, this anti-Islam video, this anti-prophet video that went up on
American
YouTube.
American-made, was in Cairo,
yes.
and maybe spillover here, they said, but maybe that
yep,
wasn't
there were the protests.
Reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, protests in Cairo, protests in Tunisia, protests across the Middle East about this, and as well protests in Libya. So for people who don't quite remember, the day after the attacks, the main narrative was that the video was the main and only cause of the attacks. This proved to be less true, that people did take advantage of the protests to actually go in for a pre-planned attack. But the fact is that it was part of the narrative. I mean, they weren't lying. They made a mistake, and they have said that they made a mistake when they sent former UN ambassador and now National Security Advisor Susan Rice out on the Sunday shows to talk about Benghazi when they didn't have everything lined up yet, exactly the timeline of what happened when. So all of these things keep compounding into we can't trust Hillary, we can't trust the Clintons. And I think that if people look closely at what, for example, the House Armed Services Committee issued a report saying that there was no way that military could get to the compound in Benghazi during the time of the attack. This was a Republican-led committee, and they agreed. So there, a lot of the outstanding questions that people have been asked and answered.
Jack, you know, maybe it's compounding on trust issues, but lately Hillary's positives seem to be compounding in some ways. I mean, since the debate where she turned in a pretty strong performance, she has seemed more confident. She certainly kept her composure there yesterday. There was none of that "what does it matter" stuff from earlier hearings. Net-net, politically, how do you think she's coming out of this, Jack?
Well, Tom, you know, the FBI inquiry and the possible security breaches in your emails, that still shadows her campaign. Otherwise, though,
we haven't heard it much from that.
No, but it's out there. Otherwise, her path to the nomination, seemingly so rocky just weeks ago, is now clear and straight and smooth. The Biden withdrawal is a boon to her. She was the second choice of nearly all his voters in recent polls, according to the New York Times. With Biden in the race, she had the support of 47% of Democrats. Without Biden, the support of 58%. So, yes, things have been breaking her way since that strong performance in the Democratic debate.
We've got callers here from Texas and Alabama and all over, but I can only get to so many on Hillary. We've got to go to Biden and Paul Ryan as well. One more on this. Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on.
Thanks, Tom. So I'm listening to this, and I guess I didn't realize there were actually 17 investigations, and it's so disgusting. You know, I am a Democrat. I'm not particularly supporting Hillary. I'm an O'Malley supporter. And I do think if we're going to worry about anything, it should be her corporate ties to big business and big banks. So to me, this is just one more attempt by the Republicans to discredit somebody that they are fearful of. They are afraid of her. And if they would put just half of the amount of attention that they're putting on this into an illegal war that we went into on false pretenses, then I think we might get somewhere. You know, it's kind of like the fog of questioning here.
You want to go back to the Iraq War and George W. I appreciate your call, Laura. Lisa, what do you see coming here? Trey Gowdy saying more to come, but, you know, ever since we had his majority leader there in the House talking about how this was done for polls, some wind out of his sails, will they keep flogging this at some point? Does it come back as a liability to keep going after it?
They are continuing to pursue this. And the next big date to watch for is the end of the year, January. That's when Chairman Gowdy has said he wants to have their final report done. Now, that doesn't mean we'll see it then, because there will probably be classified portions of that report that need to be unclassified. That could take some time. Which leads us to, March, April, that's a pretty important political time.
And once you're there, I guess Benghazi stays with us one way or another all the way to November at that point.
I think that's right. And just to put a fine point on what Laura said, it's 17 different hearings were held by other congressional committees. That's not to say there's 17 separate investigations, but there were 17 other hearings.
On Wednesday, Vice President Joe Biden ended months of speculation there in the Rose Garden at the White House with the president and his wife at his side. Said he would not enter, after all, the 2016 presidential race.
As my family and I have worked through the grieving process, I've said all along what I've said time and again to others, that it may very well be that process, by the time we get through it, closes the window on mounting a realistic campaign for president. I've concluded it has closed.
Okay. Jack, I'll come first to you on this one. There's Joe Biden in the Rose Garden, and you saw that look in his eyes. This is a guy, well, he ran for president a couple of times. That dream was there. And on Wednesday, the dream went away. What do you say, Jack?
Well, you know, Tom, he couldn't get off the stage of public life. So he started his own presidential boomlet. He told Maureen Dowd that his dying son, Beau, urged him to run for president, saying the country needed Biden values, not Clinton values. That was in August. The email controversy then was hurting Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Biden was signaling he'd step in when she faltered. She did not falter, and he did not run. He said, "I believe we're out of time," in the Rose Garden announcement. But, you know, he was out of time long before now. As you say, he had run for president twice before. His first campaign after it really ended after he was caught by Maureen Dowd plagiarizing a speech by a British politician. His second campaign in 2008 did not survive the first contest. And, you know, his causes during his decades as a senator from Delaware, anti-busing in the 70s, tough on crime bill in the 90s, the interests of home state credit card companies, they would be baggage for him in mounting a third campaign today. Truly, Joe Biden was out of time.
Well, let's hear from our listeners, and I'll bring it to you, Lisa and Hayes. Brian in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Brian, what do you think?
I am really disappointed that Joe Biden isn't running because I thought he was the only legitimate general election candidate for the Democrats.
Legitimate? What do you mean by that, Brian? Legitimate?
I mean that you look at Hillary Clinton's negative ratings, she's just not a strong candidate in a general election. She's going to have to turn out, you know, most of the people who might kind of support her. And then Bernie, I think most mainstream voters see as unelectable and too liberal. So I'm really worried at the prospect of the Democrats losing in two more endless wars.
The other two can't cut it. Lisa, come in here. Was Joe depending on a big Clinton stumble and he didn't see it? And he came out before the Benghazi hearing, so he didn't wait to look at that.
I think there's no question that the Clinton stumbles that we did see in the beginnings of her campaign, mm-hmm. really up until even the last 3 weeks, those were fueling the fire under Joe Biden and under many Democrats. I think just as Brian was saying, there are Democrats who are concerned about what happens when Hillary Clinton becomes a candidate, which is that these sort of email type items pop up and then she always has a decision of how she and the Clinton team react to them. Sometimes they do not react well to them, as we saw. But now she's had a major course correction that is clearly working for her. And I think that the fact that that course correction is working also contributed to Joe Biden's decision to stay out.
Hayes, how do you see the vice president's decision here? Was he ready to be the guy on the white horse if Hillary Clinton really got in trouble and the trouble wasn't enough? Or do you see a genuine emotional struggle, still thinking about Beau Biden, his son and his death, couldn't, got over that too late?
I mean, Biden's been in politics for decades now. He saw the way the wind was blowing and realized that he couldn't mount a credible campaign within the amount of time necessary. He had no real funding. He had no campaign structure set up. And really, I think in this world, no one more upset about that fact than the staff writers at The Onion.
Yes, with their crocodile tears. Elaine in Brookline, Massachusetts. Elaine, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was a supporter of the vice president, and I think that people gloss over the gift that this man had of bringing us together, of making the wheels of the machinery of government work, reaching across the aisle. Much has been made of what he said about not calling Republicans the enemy, and everyone says this was a little shot across the bow to Clinton. I think it's got a broader meaning than that. We all complain about the incivility in Washington, and it's growing throughout the country thanks to Donald Trump. We needed somebody who was uplifting. There is no one else, possibly Kasich, had he been given a chance, mm-hmm. but that's about it. And nobody talks about that. That kind of grace that he had and that ability to lift us up and make us a great country, because building walls doesn't make you a great country.
Eileen, we've got it, and I'm glad to hear it from you. Jack Beatty, there, whatever your critique of Joe Biden may be, you hear that yearning for somebody who can bridge all this, that is ultimately necessary.
Yes, and she's very, very right that he spoke to that yesterday. But on the, you know, Tom, though, on the other hand, Joe Biden, in his debate, vice presidential debate with Paul Ryan, was sneering, contemptuous, full of a sort of contumely toward this young sprout daring to run for vice president. It wasn't a unifying performance, so he was capable of being peevish on the stage, too. But I agree that overall, he's shown the political gift of just kind of getting along with people, and it's helped the Obama administration in some tight spots over the past years.
Could we look over the party fence for just a minute? Because in the GOP race, you have some interesting poll numbers this week where Ben Carson's doing pretty darn well in Iowa, and I want to ask the three of you what you make of that. Here he was, I mean, and he's doing well when he's not technically campaigning. He's got a new book out. He's on book tour. Here he was in Edmond, Oklahoma on Wednesday talking about why he thought he, Ben Carson, was resonating with voters.
Well, I think a lot of people in the country realize that we're in critical condition as a nation. And, you know, if we don't get it straightened out this time, we may not get it straightened out.
Hayes Brown, what do you make of the Carson candidacy? I mean, he's, you know, he's almost holds it at arm's length sometime, and yet it rises and rises.
I think that might be part of the reason why he's doing so well. He's capturing a moment when, well, yet again, people say that they don't want a politician as their president. And so he's look at the words he used just then. He said critical condition. It reminds people subliminally he's a doctor, not a politician. He knows how to heal the country.
Lisa, is there something subliminal that comes from him in addition to what's the secret sauce with Ben Carson? Donald Trump must be wondering.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's interesting. Donald Trump has been most careful in his handling of Ben Carson more than almost anyone else on the trail. I think he doesn't know quite how to handle him or approach him, and he realizes he shouldn't attack him straight out, that that's a problem for him. My theory about Ben Carson, but I have to tell you, we don't know exactly who his voters are yet. They're obviously conservative voters. I think that we know that they're value voters when we look at the crosstabs on polls. I think Ben Carson is managing to take that wing of the Republican Party that Rick Santorum had the last time around that propelled him to first place on that squeaker-thin victory in Iowa on January in 2012. Those are people who, many of them are homeschoolers. That's a very organized group that feels very strongly about their politicians. I think the groups who are anti-abortion, pro-life, I think they are backing Carson. They feel like he is someone who is true to their creed, and they want a candidate. They realize how important this election is for those issues and for the future of the Supreme Court, and they're going with Carson right now. Now, question is, do they stay with Carson? Does Carson stay viable? If you look at his fundraising, he's raised a lot of money, but he's spent almost more money than anyone else to get that fundraising. He's done a lot of direct mail, which is very expensive. So there are some kind of long-term questions about the Carson campaign, and also his own interview on Marketplace with Kai Ryssdal, where it seemed he didn't really understand what something as important as the national debt was. Those are questions he's going to have to answer, and he's going to probably have to answer them soon after this book tour.
Jack, what do you see in the appeal here? I mean, he's so chill, almost Sphinx-like sometimes. It's a kind of calm silence. You wouldn't normally think that would be the big draw.
No, you wouldn't. And yet he says really incendiary things in that calm manner. Mm-hmm. For example, this week he said he was musing aloud that, no, he doesn't want to abolish the Department of Education. After all, he has a mission for it. He wants it to investigate political bias in colleges. And if they find that a college or people in the college, professors, are politically biased, the federal government should withdraw funding from that university. Well, you know, that would be the most, that would be a wholesale assault on freedom of speech, sort of unprecedented. He just threw that out as a kind of, well, calm, I'm being reasonable. I want to keep the Department of Education around.
Different mission. Speak softly and carry one big old stick there. Jack Beatty, please stand by. Hayes Brown with BuzzFeed. Lisa Desjardins with PBS NewsHour. We're looking at a week in the news. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, new mammogram guidelines from the American Cancer Society, pushing back the recommended age for annual mammograms from 40 to 45. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology still says start at age 40.
It's frustrating for women who want to do the right thing, and they're constantly being told something different.
Cancer survivor Amy Kaffer there. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, Tony Torres confessed to killing 4-year-old Lily Garcia in a road rage shooting Tuesday. Here's Judge Chris Schultz on the crime.
This is possibly one of the most wanton and atrocious acts as alleged, I think, in the history of this city.
Just terrible. And released, the second Star Wars trailer was...
The Force. It's calling to you.
We're looking at a week in the news this hour, and you can join us. Is Paul Ryan right to take up the speaker role? What do you think of Assad in Moscow with Vladimir Putin? Is Putin now calling the tune in the Middle East? And what about John Kerry with Netanyahu and Abbas? What should Kerry be saying? Hayes Brown is with us, world news editor, reporter for BuzzFeed News. Lisa Desjardins of the PBS NewsHour, political editor there, is with us. Jack Beatty's here. John Boehner just waiting for somebody to come along and relieve him. Paul Ryan said for a long time, no, no, no. On Tuesday, he said he would be willing to run for Speaker of the House under certain conditions. Listed a few.
First, we need to move from an opposition party to being a proposition party. Because we think the nation is on the wrong path, we have a duty to show the right one. Our next speaker has to be a visionary one. Second, we need to update our House rules so that everyone can be a more effective representative. But we need to do this as a team. And it needs to include fixes that ensure that we do not experience constant leadership challenges and crises. Third, we as a conference should unify now and not after a divisive speaker election.
And fourth and more, I'm going home to my family on the weekends. Don't expect me to work 24 hours a day. A really interesting week with Paul Ryan, the Freedom Caucus saying, well, enough of them, I guess, saying they're behind him, Lisa, that he says he will now stand for speaker. Does he have that ironclad unity in hand that puts him on a different horse than the Bronco John Boehner rode?
I don't think he does. I think he does have the support to become speaker, but I think something very telling is he wanted an endorsement of the Freedom Caucus. That's 80% of the most conservative members of the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. He didn't get the 80%, so they didn't endorse him. He did get a majority, so that's significant. But I think that what this tells us is that the underlying dynamic here has not changed, and we have three crises coming up. The House may be able to deal with the debt ceiling crisis with a bill next week. They're hoping to get that done before Paul Ryan takes over so he doesn't have to fight his own party on that. Mm-hmm. But then we're going to have a potential government shutdown. Funding for government runs out in December. And to be honest, the House Freedom Caucus, they're not changing their position, I don't think, on whether Planned Parenthood should be funded and whether they go to the mattresses on that issue. I think that one other sort of wonky thing that I love I can talk about on this great show is Paul Ryan, when he talked about rules changes, he wasn't just talking about changes that would help the House Freedom Caucus get more amendments on the floor, give them more of a voice. He wants those. But he also wanted to change an important rule called vacating the chair. That is the rule that the House Freedom Caucus used essentially to push Boehner out. They threatened this vacating of the chair, which would force the speaker out. The Speaker Boehner didn't want to even have that vote. He stepped aside. It's a majority vote, and Paul Ryan wants to change that to be a two-thirds vote, essentially taking the kind of the gun away from his head that conservatives have, and the Freedom Caucus is not supporting that. So that's an indication that the same dynamics underlying all of this may still be in place. It is now a question of the strength of Paul Ryan's leadership, and he will be tested.
Jack, here they come, as Lisa says, right in here he comes, if indeed all this happens next week, and that appears to be on the rails now, straight into the buzzsaw of some of the most potentially controversial and difficult moments a speaker can face. Do you see enough unity emerging out of Boehner's resignation and this kind of embarrassing struggle to find someone to step up and tackle all this that might end the division within the GOP and bring something more orderly to congressional action and government here?
Well, one would like to think that the Freedom Caucus would recognize that this is really the star of their party. He's a very good on television. He makes Boehner sort of mailed it in. This is a policy wonk. He can talk about anything. So he'd be great from the image point of view. But then their pressures, that Freedom Caucus, on those legislators is all to the right. Someone looked at this. And they beat, on average, they beat their Democratic opponents, the Freedom Caucus people, by 38 points. They are completely invulnerable from Democratic,
beat them. You mean in their home districts when they ran for re-election?
Yes,
They're in solid districts, unshakable. Why should they compromise? You're saying,
exactly. And their only threat is from somebody even further from the right, and the right is defined by we don't compromise. So I don't see how I don't see that their interests align with the interests of governing.
45-year-old. Yep, that's Paul Ryan. He's walking right into that. 45 years old, would be the youngest speaker in a century, I think I heard, with kids at home, and he wants to spend time with them. Chelsea in Nashville. Chelsea, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question has to do, well, not question, but rather a statement, about Paul Ryan and if anyone's going to address the hypocrisy in him wanting to run but saying he's not going to sacrifice family time when he voted against child care subsidies and parental paid leave for 4 weeks.
Yeah, that was very notable. Hayes Brown, I mean, he stepped up and said, okay, but don't ask me to be at your beck and call 24 hours a day. I've got family. I'm putting family first. And, yes, there is a voting record here that's not exactly perfect on that front, as Chelsea points out. I mean, perfect by her lights or those pushing for more. But Paul Ryan says, for me, I've got to have this.
Which is pretty astonishing, considering the fact that, I mean, the Speaker of the House, I mean, it's one of the worst jobs in Washington at this point, and he is going to have to be on call 24/7 if he wants to do this right, because he's going to be wrangling these caucus members from the Freedom Caucus and from the other parts of his party, trying to get them in line. I'm so old that I remember when the GOP was the party of party discipline. When
Hayes. It's incredible.
I know, I'm ancient. That you knew back then that the GOP would vote in a block on pretty much anything, no matter what. The so-called Hastert rule, where you would only bring something to the floor if the majority agreed to it, made sense then, because they would all fall into lockstep. So if we get a Speaker Ryan, he is not going to be able to enjoy the luxury time with his family, or at least what he would consider for other families luxury time when he has to deal with this sort of thing.
It's going to be fascinating. We may be in a calm right before the storm here with the crises that you list there, Lisa, potential crises coming, certainly deadlines coming up right in front of us. Jack, you say John Boehner mailed it in, but that allowed him to be kind of vague about things.
Yes.
Paul Ryan has a history of being able to articulate right down to every little detail, and if he does that, where does the Freedom Caucus go at that point? I'm going to spin the globe kind of dramatically here away from that. We'll see what happens with the speaker next week. Meanwhile, you've got Assad of Syria, he who has been told he must go by the United States and a whole lot of other people for the first time in years, now having international travel on a jaunt up to Moscow, sitting with Vladimir Putin on Tuesday and thanking the Russian president for his help in fighting the rebels in the Syrian civil war. Assad calling them, like Putin, terrorists, interpreted here by Reuters.
In the terrorism that has spread throughout the region now, if it wasn't for your actions and your decisions, it would have taken over much bigger areas and would have spread over a bigger part of the state.
Ah, my good friend Vladimir. And Putin, the new, overlord, at least of the PR game in the Middle East, pledging his support to Syria and the Assad regime. Again, Reuters interpreting from Moscow.
Syria is a friendly country to us, and we're prepared to do whatever we can, not only in the course of military efforts to fight terrorism, but also in the course of the political process.
Hayes Brown, is this where the future of the region now gets hammered out? Moscow.
I don't think so. Former Ambassador to Russia, McFaul from the
Michael
U.S. Michael McFaul, he had a great op-ed in the New York Times today that said that Putin is very good at tactical ideas. He's very good at seeing when there's a weakness and striking. He's bad at long-term thinking, though. And in the long term, his strategy in Syria is uncertain. So he got into it claiming that it was to help in the fight against ISIS. But What's been interesting about Syria since 2011 is that the rhetoric coming out from Syria and as well from Russia has been that anyone who says that Assad should step down is basically a terrorist. So that was the reason why they first started when peaceful protests broke out there. They started the crackdown that led to rebels that gave ISIS the room to grow. So the idea that in striking back against the rebels and in doing more civilian damage along the lines that Assad has, Russia is somehow going to broker a peace in Syria seems out there to me.
Interesting sort of object lesson here for Americans in how the word terrorist can be used. Among these rebels are people supported by the United States, and Assad and Russia now blandly calling them terrorists. And you can see all the sorts of wrinkles and realities that word can be spread over. Hey, let's take us further. It's not as though the United States isn't out there. It's not as though there's not a bombing campaign. It's not as though they're not watching all over the place. And this week, for the first time in a long time, and the first time since the U.S. sort of turned back in toward ISIS, an American casualty on the ground. Now identified, Master Sergeant Joshua Wheeler, 39 years old, of Roland, Oklahoma, dying there in Kirkuk province as part of this raid to rescue what they thought, I guess, were Kurds from ISIS. They'd seen from space a big trench had been dug as though they were going to mow them down. They went in. I don't think they really were Kurds, but what was the American soldier doing there? What do we know, Hayes?
We know not too much this time since it was, an operation. So the administration is saying that this was to support the mission, that it was not a solely American mission, that they were there solely to aid in the operation. This, I think, illustrates the fact that despite the fact that we've had promises of no boots on the ground from both Republicans and Democrats, the fact of the matter is you don't have to have the giant sort of scale invasion that we saw during the war in Iraq to have people actually on the ground operating who are actually down there in actual live fire against ISIS in this case.
Do we have any sense of, he came down from Erbil, we're told, though that isn't one of the places that we understood the U.S. military to be so much on the ground in a combat role, certainly. No other explanation of what happened here out of the Pentagon at this point?
To be honest, I am not seeing much from them at this time, so I'm hoping that we'll get more cleared up over exactly what the roles and responsibilities of the U.S. Because in the past, they've been very clear that aside from what they refer to as special operations missions, that the role of the U.S. military in Erbil and in Baghdad and during these confrontations against ISIS, aside from flying like the bombing missions, is to just advise and train the Iraqi military. So this is an escalation definitely in what we've seen the U.S. military actually doing during this fight.
John Kerry talking about the region, but not in it, in Europe this week, talking with the Israeli leader, Benjamin Netanyahu. We'll be talking with Abbas. Here he was yesterday in Berlin, urging peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
We have to stop incitement. We have to stop the violence. And I think it's critical. Obviously, this conversation that you and I will have is very important to settle on the steps that can be taken that take us beyond the condemnation, beyond the rhetoric.
What about the throw weight there, Hayes? The United States, any with Israelis and Palestinians at this point? Is this just rhetoric in Europe?
We're hoping not, but the situation on the ground in Israel-Palestine is different than we've seen before. Rather than being, really directed by, say, the Hamas or the Palestinian Authority, the violence that we're seeing is much more organic than we're used to. The Palestinians who have been accused and who actually have carried out attacks against Israelis wielding knives or cars, for that matter, have not been ordered to do so. No one can see any linkage between any of them. They're just operating on their own. And with the spread of video, their videos are going viral, sometimes without context, inspiring more attacks. And it's just sort of snowballing into the situation that we're seeing. And we're seeing as well Israelis taking up arms to retaliate against Palestinians. Just the other day, there was a case where the Israeli security forces took on what they thought was a Palestinian attacker who turned out to be an Israeli Jew, and they shot him and killed him on the street. So there's a lot of paranoia in the air in the region. There's a lot of concern about just how they're going to – the political leaders who many of the people on the ground are losing faith in are going to be able to clamp down on the violence this time.
And then there's this Netanyahu in Jerusalem on Tuesday saying that a Palestinian gave Hitler the idea to kill the Jews. I'll let him speak for himself.
Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews at the time. He wanted to expel the Jews. And Haj Amin al-Husseini went to Hitler and said, if you expel them, they'll all come here. So what should I do with them? He asked. You said, burn them.
Putting it on the Holocaust on the Grand Mufti there, Israeli historian Moshe Zimmerman from Hebrew University talking with CNN on Wednesday, flatly rejecting that, saying that's not what was behind the Holocaust. Not true, said the Israeli historian.
The killing of the Jews was already a fact. Hitler didn't need any kind of advice from somebody, and of course not the advice of some small fry like the Mufti of Jerusalem. So the whole dialogue that Netanyahu mentioned was invented.
Ahistorical. Jack Beatty, when you lay that on the Palestinians, that is hardly a path to peace.
You talk about Holocaust. You talk about incitement. My God, I can't believe that he did that. On the other hand, he has taken some good steps. He said, we won't allow our ministers to go to the Temple Mount, and we want to keep the status quo there, but the Palestinians don't believe it.
Let's try and keep the history straight. We know there are lots of complexities here, but the basic history, let's try and keep it straight. Thanks to all three of you for being with us today. Hayes Brown with BuzzFeed, world news editor there. Hayes, thank you very much for joining us from New York.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Desjardins, political editor for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks for joining us, Lisa.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
And Jack, thank you as always, sir. Have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.